Well, friends, fabulous to be with you once again for our fifth week in our Lenten series, Crown and Cross, walking through Mark's Gospel. Today we are in Mark chapter 10. It'd be really helpful if you have Mark 10 open, verses 32 through to 52. I wonder if you can remember a time where you have been really looking forward to something. So it's been a long time coming and you've planned or saved, you've prayed, you've prepared. You just can't wait. You know, expectation is such a powerful thing, isn't it? I can remember a few years ago taking my eldest daughter, Susanna, who's now 10, off to a toy store. Now, Susanna's birthday is December 26, so it's a long time between presents for her in a year. So we try to look for an opportunity to give her something in the middle of the year. We make up something. So anyway, we headed off to our local Westfield. The deal was Dad was going to put in 10 bucks, and if she wanted to spend anything beyond that, she had to put in her own money. She had $1.40, so we had $11.40. And the full force of expectation had kicked in. And not just in the car on the way to the shops, but for the days before that Saturday morning. So, Dad, we still going to the toy store. Dad, what time are we going to the toy store? Dad, and my sister's coming to the toy store with us. I don't want them to. In the end, I said to her, Susanna, if I hear one more thing about the toy store on Saturday, we will not be going. Susanna, okay, do you understand? Look at me. Make eye contact. Got it? Yep, no worries. Dad? Yes, Susanna. What are you doing on Saturday morning first thing? Is what she said. And in the car on the way there, she was just beside herself. The power of expectation on full display. And I knew it was only going to end in one way. Disappointment. Because there was no toy on the face of the earth that could possibly live up to the expectations that Susanna had put on this small piece of plastic that she was going to come home with. You know, ministers who prepare people for marriage sometimes see a similar thing. We often meet with younger people who have a view of marriage that is not realistic nor possible. Now, no one actually puts it like this, but essentially it seems like people think, look, I'm going to get married to my one true love and life will become easier. Those insecurities I've always had will disappear overnight. My beloved and I will find bliss and peace and happiness that we just know we're destined for. And well-meaning ministers often try to explain, often to glazed eyes, that happily ever after might look a bit different from movies and TV and books that we read, and that Disney actually doesn't eventuate for anyone because you don't marry a cartoon. You marry a person. And there'll be times in your marriage when you feel like you've fallen out of love, or it's like it's just not working, or that you're just so different to each other. And that's really where marriage begins, it seems, when the expectation and the reality face off to each other in the cold light of day. And when we get expectations wrong, we can become crushed. I never knew it'd be like this. Why didn't someone tell me? Where did I go wrong? And it's at that point that we have a couple of options. We can either walk away, defeated and deflated, or we can rebuild and start again, and have new expectations, but informed and wiser second time round. Now, why this extended introduction today? It's because today we see, not for the first time, not for the second, but actually for the third in Mark's Gospel, and for the clearest and most blatant time, actually, Jesus' disciples getting their expectation about Jesus all wrong. So today in Mark's Gospel chapter 10, we're going to find three stories that are all linked by this idea of expectation. In fact, the idea of wrong expectation. The first story will set the scene for us. The second story will show us the challenge. The third story will reveal to us the answer. So we've got the scene, the challenge, and the answer. So let's set the scene. Now, where we're up to in Mark 10 and 11 is that Jesus is as popular as he's ever going to be in his earthly ministry. The academics of the day want to debate Jesus. Parents want their children blessed by him. People in the street are running up to Jesus seeking his wisdom and insight. Crowds of people want to pay homage to him. It is a picture of Jesus for all. This is the Jesus you want to be seen with. This is the Jesus who can bless you and guide you and instruct you and give you the good life. And into this context, Jesus says the following words, verse 33. We're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. So despite the fanfare and the celebrity surrounding Jesus, Jesus knows where he's going. And Jesus is in full control. Jesus is leading the crowd, not the other way around. That's why verse 32 tells us they were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way. He's going on a journey. Everyone loves a journey, right? And so in verse 33, he explains it to his disciples. Look, I'm going to Jerusalem, fellas, and I'm going to be betrayed and condemned, mocked, spat on and killed. Then I'm going to rise. Who's with me? Who's in? I mean, who wouldn't want a trip like that? A personal tour of the holy city, Jerusalem, with Jesus himself as your guide. He'll even throw in the mocking and the mucus and the murder. No, anyone seeing clearly would know that this is not the trip you want to be on. This is not the journey you want. Well, let's see how the disciples are seeing things. Look at verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. They replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. Now, does that seem a bit strange to you? Because it's here we move to the challenge in our second story. So Jesus is talking to his disciples about the darkest of roads, the bleakest of journeys before him, and two disciples, James and John, say, yeah, we know you're going to be tortured and you're going to die, but we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Seem a bit strange. Perhaps a bit insensitive. Maybe a lack of understanding of the gravity of Jesus' mission. Well, look, this does seem really hard to understand, but it absolutely ties in with what we find again and again and again in Mark's gospel, that there is a huge gulf that exists between the Messiah who does turn up in Jesus and the Messiah people were hoping and expecting would turn up. And even here, Jesus' disciples still don't get it. See, this is the third time Jesus has told them why he has come, but they have not heard, they are not seeing. They are blind. Now, just in case you haven't seen this yet in Mark's gospel, at this time in the first century, every Jew was waiting for a particular king, a Messiah, the Christ, who would come and rescue them. He would be a king like their best ever king, a king like David, who lived 1,000 years earlier, and a king who they would refer to as the son of David. And this brilliant king, this son of David, would come into the royal city, Jerusalem, and he would come to restore the glory of David's throne. That's what all the Jews were waiting for. And so James and John hear Jesus speaking about going to Jerusalem and being raised in glory. Those key words have hit them. And they think, here we go. Showtime. We knew this guy was special. That's why we followed him. We bet everything on him. Now it's payday. So in verse 37, they say to Jesus, look, when you're king of the world, we'd like to be at your left and right. That is, give us some positions of honour and authority. It's almost like they've heard the first and last part of Jesus' message and missed out the entire middle. They've heard, we're going to Jerusalem. 3 days later, I'll rise. Now, it is very easy for us right now to sit back on our lounges, isn't it, and to think to ourselves, idiots. But you know what? The 10 other disciples make the same mistake. Look at verse 41. When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. You see, they're no better than James and John. And they don't want James and John to be better than them. They may well be annoyed that they didn't get in first. Now, what's going on here? This is the issue of expectation. You see, Jesus asks them a very important question here. In verse 36, notice this, Jesus asks James and John, what do you want me to do for you? Have no doubt that is a question of expectation. What do you want from me? What do you expect me to do for you? And they answer, when you come in glory, when you're crowned king in Jerusalem, we want to be chief of staff and prime minister. We want glory too. We want honour too. We want status too. We want dignity as well. They are looking to Jesus to see who Jesus will make them. And the giveaway is in the question they ask him. We want you to do for us whatever we ask. You know, the human desire for dignity and status is well founded. We all long to be honoured and respected And that is absolutely right. Most of us know and feel, don't we, that as people we are worthy of dignity. But we all know, we all feel that being human brings with it a special and inherent value. That's why when you have a two-year-old here and a dog here, and the dog tries to lick your toddler's face, you don't say to the toddler, "Sweetheart, don't let your dirty face go anywhere near our beautiful dog's clean mouth." Do you? No, no, what we say is, "Sweetheart, don't let the dog lick your face. Get away, bad dog." Status lies with the child. We know, don't we? We feel, we believe that a child has special status and honour that is above an animal. We do. The impulse is right. And that's because at the beginning of the Bible, we are told that people and people alone are made in the image of God. That's why we're worthy of honour and status. Because God himself has allowed something of his honour and status to be imprinted upon us, to be stitched within us, to be reflected by human beings. That's what it means to be made in God's image. The abolition of slavery was built upon this understanding. The modern concept of human rights, equality and liberty fall out of this idea that human beings are inherently valuable. But here's the thing. To be made in the image of God means that our dignity and worth... let me start again. To be made in the image of God means that our dignity and our worth is derived. We're not valuable because I feel valuable. We're valuable because God has made us like him, of enormous worth. And where people get into trouble, where people get this wrong, is where they start to run with this idea that we are valuable, which is true, but they do so with no reference to the one who has made us valuable, which is sin. So James and John, back to them, their impulse is correct. They do deserve dignity. They have been made in the image of God. The mistake they make is seen in the question, "We want you to do for us whatever we ask." They have forgotten that their value is derived from God. And they are seeking a dignity apart from God. Yes, sure, at Jesus' right and left hand, but Jesus here has become a tool to make them feel valuable and to make them feel better than others. He's no longer the object of their worship and affection. Essentially, they're now thinking of Jesus in terms of what they can get out of him and how he can help them get ahead of others. Their expectation is all wrong. Recently, I was speaking to someone who was talking to me about a large church that is in my area of Sydney, who had got together all the self-employed people who ran small businesses in their church and had a conference where they were slowing down to talk and pray about how God might bless them all with the God idea, that would set their business up to be a financial success above and beyond any other similar businesses around them. So what they're being taught, and hear this, is that God wanted them to be wealthy and successful, and so they would ask God to give them the God idea to help them get there. Which raises the question, what is your expectation of Jesus? Who do you think he is? What sort of king is he? What's he come to do? And as people who have predominantly grown up in the individualistic and materialistic secular West, it is very easy, isn't it, to start to think that Jesus has come for me, for my prosperity. Because that really is the air that we've breathed our whole lives. Jesus just makes life better. Now, don't miss the deep irony in that way of thinking. Jesus died because of the claims he made. Tradition has it that almost all the disciples and apostles died for trusting in Jesus. The New Testament shows us that to be a Christian in the first century was essentially to be a persecuted minority. Secular history tells us that Emperor Nero lit his garden parties with the burning bodies of Christians. You see, the closer in time to Jesus that Christians lived, the more likely it would be that you would be killed for trusting in him. Take up your cross and follow me actually meant that you might. But today it's come full circle almost, where Jesus is presented as a solution to any problem that someone might have. Now maybe you've heard this quote before, I'm not sure, but this is how the American Christian psychologist David Pallison describes what he sees going on with modern Christianity. Listen to this. In this new gospel, the great evils to be redressed do not call for any fundamental change of direction in the human heart. Instead, the problem lies in my sense of rejection from others, in my corrosive experience of life's vanity, in my nervous sense of self-condemnation and diffidence, in the imminent threat of boredom if my music is turned off, in my fussy complaints when a long, hard road lies ahead. These are the significant felt needs that the gospel is bent to serve. Jesus and the church exist to make you feel loved, significant, validated, entertained, and charged up. This gospel alleviates distressing symptoms. It makes you feel better. The logic of this therapeutic gospel is a Jesus for me who meets individual desires and alleviates psychic aches. Brothers and sisters, beware the impulse that lies in all our hearts of wanting greatness and honour in this life apart from Jesus. And beware of the Christianized version of it around us, and ironically in many parts of Africa, that Jesus wants to make you great as the world understands greatness. It is a lie, but we buy it, and so do the disciples. But even in this section, Jesus reminds his disciples and us why he came and what real greatness is and what sort of king he is. It's verse 43. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. Jesus here reminds his disciples of the upside-down nature of the gospel. Do you want to be great? Then become a slave. True greatness finds you when you give up your search for it. And then Jesus, in a key verse, describes why he came. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. God himself, the Messiah, the Son of David, the long-awaited King, didn't come to be served, but to serve, to give his life away. Now that line there means that Jesus knows he has come to be a substitutionary sacrifice, because that word ransom there in the original language is a word used to describe the purchasing of the freedom of a slave or prisoner. The word for there in the original language, for even the Son, in the original language is the word that means instead of or in the place of. Do you see what Jesus is saying? Do you see what Jesus believed his kingship was all about? He came to purchase or pay the price for slaves and prisoners instead of them or in their place so they could go free, to give his life as a ransom for many. Now, no wonder the disciples didn't get it, because no one in the history of the world has ever lived like this. And brothers and sisters, watch out for any teaching of any church here or near that appeals to status, the very thing that Jesus himself here says, don't go there. This is not what I'm about. Don't be so blind. Don't be blinded by glory, by power, by status. The key question here, what do you want me to do for you, reveals so much of James's and John's expectation. But that identical question of Jesus comes up again, and it is what ties our stories together. So now we're in verse 46, and we now have Jesus heading into Jericho, and we see he meets a man by the road called Bartimaeus, who is blind and begging. Now this is an amazing little section, and Mark absolutely wants us to see this section as the answer to the previous, because another man here requests something from Jesus. And the first thing to notice is what he calls Jesus. Did you see that? He says, Jesus, Son of David. This is the only time in Mark's gospel someone uses this title for Jesus, but we are being shown a man here who expects Jesus to be the long-awaited king. This blind man believes Jesus to be the Messiah who is coming into Jerusalem, just like the disciples believed. But the blind man sees things differently. And here is his request, verse 47. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. So both James and John, the disciples, and the blind man here recognize Jesus to be the long-awaited king, and both ask for something from him, don't they? James and John, who can see, ask for status. Bartimaeus, who is blind, asks for mercy. And Jesus puts the identical question to both of them. What do you want me to do for you? James and John, who can see, asks for glory, honour and power. Bartimaeus, who is blind, asks for sight. notice a couple of things hugely significant. Firstly, Bartimaeus is a blind beggar. He has nothing. He's a picture of desperate destitution. And then we're told in verse 50, see that? Throwing his cloak aside. That is a wonderful, tiny addition which adds so much. It is a picture of a man leaving all he has, his coat. The one thing a blind person would have to keep him warm, to protect him from the elements, perhaps it's his security blanket, he throws it aside. Compared to Jesus, it's worthless. And this blind man who comes to Jesus finds sight. But do you know what the point is? The man already had sight. He got Jesus' identity right. He knew that the Son of David brought mercy, not status. And he knew that coming to Jesus meant leaving every worldly entrapment behind. The point of the whole story? The blind man can see. The seeing disciples are blind. Coming to Jesus is not about status and power and God ideas and what I can get out of it. It is about seeking mercy from God and leaving all behind to follow and serve Jesus. Well, friends, you know, there is a very important question that Jesus asks twice in this passage, and both times it diagnoses the hearts of those Jesus asks. What do you want me to do for you? And today Jesus asks you, what do you want me to do for you? And that question cuts straight to the heart of your expectation. It is a question that will actually diagnose your heart. Well, what is your answer when Jesus says to you, what do you want me to do for you? If your answer has anything to do with God ideas or the success of your business or your health or status or power or dignity or honour, be prepared for great and personal crushing. Because our wrong expectation can only lead to being disillusioned and crushed. I never knew it would be like this. Why didn't someone tell me? Where did I go wrong? It's at that point that we have a couple of options. We can either walk away defeated and deflated, or we can start again and rebuild our expectations in new and informed and wiser ways. And my brothers and sisters here today, here is the wiser way. And it comes from Jesus himself. He says this, instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. You see, true greatness is found when we abandon our search for it and instead choose to live as a servant of Jesus first and then all. Then we find greatness, not our own, but derived, a greatness given to us by the only great one. The one who gave his life as a ransom for many. And then we see Jesus, like blind Bartimaeus, as the Son of David, the King of Israel, who came to bring mercy to the broken. I trust you can see him. I trust you know him.